fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
No! Don't go in there! You don't have to die! Well, no one has to die at 30! You can live! Live! Live and grow old! I've seen it! She's seen it! Well, look! 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 It's clear!
Last day, Capricorn 29s. Year of the City, 2274. Carousel begins.
No! Don't! Don't go! Listen to him! He's telling the truth! We've been outside! There's another world outside! We've seen it!
The life clocks are alive! Carousel is alive! There is no renewal! Only one! Leave me!
Leave this!
Hogan 5. Did you find sanctuary? Did you find sanctuary? We will begin surrogation. Are engaged. Logan 5, you were assigned to find a place called Sanctuary. Report.
There is no sanctuary.
Unacceptable. The answer does not program. You were assigned to locate missing runners. State what you found.
All frozen.
The input does not program, Logan 5. You may not resist.
An old man.
You must not resist, Logan 5. Did you find sanctuary? Broke city seals and went outside. Confirm outside.
All ruined, exposed. There is no sanctuary.
Answer the question.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 64. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This show is being released on Monday, February 8, 2010. My interview with George Clayton Johnson was recorded on January 8, 2010. What do Merlin the Magician, Twilight Zone, Star Trek, Kung Fu, Ocean's 11, Logan's Run, and the Hemp Movement have in common? today's guest, and we'll be traveling with him to the realm between science and superstition that lies across the oceans, through the stars, and into the twilight zone. I've known George Clayton Johnson for about 17 years, and in my early 20s, he was the man that not only inspired me to become a writer, but was literally the one who taught me how to observe. George is the author of Ocean's 11, the first episode of Star Trek, the original episode, that is, 8 episodes of Twilight Zone, the TV series Kung Fu, and the movie Logan's Run, amongst others, including a few books. And I met up with him for lunch at a cafe out in Los Angeles at the beginning of January to sit down for an interview and discuss his life as one of the world's most famous science fiction writers. And George hardly looks like he's changed a bit in all of those years, probably because he's been out kicking the can. Next time you hear children outside playing kick the can, you can probably bet one of them is George Clayton Johnson. Upcoming shows, to be honest, next week I have no idea who's going to be on, but I have a few perspectives. John Taylor Gatto, once again, has postponed until around February 20th or thereafter. I've got a few things lined up in the meantime, so hopefully one of them pans out by next week. If not, maybe I'll take a break. I could sure use one. Donations. This week, my love and thanks goes out to Dr. Craig, Philip, Greg, Matthew, Christian, and Cheryl. This show is dedicated to all of you, and thank you all so much. And if you'd like to donate directly to Gnostic Media, please go to GnosticMedia.com and click on the donation button near the top left of the website. This show is run mostly on donations. We are not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives from the website, you help to continue our programming. And without your help, we would cease to be here. And I'd like to mention that also this week I just put out a black and white edition of my book, The Holy Mushroom, that came out originally in 2008, and this is a second printing of that book, and it is heavily discounted over the color version that's been out for more than a year now. So if you've been thinking about getting one of those, you can pick that up in the black and white edition for a lot cheaper. And I still have copies of John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, softcover edition. Allegro's book was one of the most controversial books written in the 20th century, so if you haven't read that, do check that out. It's a new updated 40th anniversary edition with a preface by myself, a foreword by Judith Ann Brown, and an addendum by Professor Carl A.P. Ruck from Boston University. And still offering 25% off of most items on the website, except for the John Allegro books, so you can check that stuff out up there. And of course, my love and thanks goes out to everyone who has purchased something off the website. Can't thank you enough for your support, and things have been slowing down lately, so we really appreciate everyone who has been making donations or ordering something. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And if you would like to go to the website is www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And if you would like to contact me, you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support, and here is my interview with George Clayton Johnson, or Merlin the Magician.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block-long limousine, EO-11, EO-11. Someday I'll have me a penthouse, stacks and stacks of folding green, EO-11, EO-11. It's all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place down there or heaven. In the meantime, 11. EO 11. It is all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place.
I'm George Clayton Johnson. I'm a freelance writer. I write scripts, TV, movies, stories, essays, articles. I've done so for 50 years. My credits start with Ocean's 11, a movie I sold. It took 6 years to get made. And during those 6 years, with the encouragement of my wife Lola, I set out to learn what writers do so that I might become a writer, because I admired them all of my life. I looked at people like Jack London and Edgar Rice Burroughs as heroes and guides and gods, and I wanted to be among them. And now I had this opportunity to try and find out how to do it. I tried to learn everything. What does an agent do? If you wanted to be an agent, what would you need to know? What does a producer do? What does a director do? In the course of it, I wrote many, many outlines, stories, scripts, all of which were rejected. Finally, I wrote a short story, met an agent, gave him the story. He gave it to Rod Serling's Twilight Zone program, and I got an offer to buy The Four of Us, or All of Us Are Dying, which was its title originally, All of Us Are Dying, to Rod Serling, which he then adapted into a teleplay, and he wanted another story, Execution, then he wanted another story, A Penny for Your Thoughts. I told him that I wouldn't sell it to him unless he gave me the opportunity to write a first draft screenplay, because I felt I was entitled to do so, because it's one thing to write the story and to collaborate with the best known writer in America, and a great honor, but at the same time I would really love to be a screenwriter, and so that's the situation. And I was told no, and then I went home. Well, I was really told we'll think about it, but I took it as a no when after 2 weeks I had not heard from them. And then I got a call from a lawyer named Gerald Saltzman, who worked for a big firm called Berowitz and Gordon, which were the legal attorneys for Cayuga Productions, which was Rod Serling's company. And he said, I have here a check and a contract, and this contract allows you to write a first draft screenplay, and that if at that time if we wish a cutoff, that's the end of it, and we are prepared now to exercise our option for you to do this, and here's the check for it. What do you say? So I took the check and went home, and now I had the problem of writing a script suitable for the Twilight Zone. I was fortunate that they took my first draft teleplay and just shot it the way it was, with Rod Serling referring to it as this dandy thing we're shooting now, and me going away from this, beginning to believe that maybe, yes, I could learn how to make a living writing television shows and stories. Well, from that day to this very one, I've been largely successful at that. I've just sold several news stories recently. I'm being considered for all manner of interesting stuff, and I've just submitted my latest screenplay to a Hollywood big agent who has accepted the idea of representing it. And so I expect big things to come very soon. And here I am at the age of 80 years, looking back at 50 years of making a living without having a job. Along that way, I, as a television writer, wrote episodes of Route 66, The Law and Mr. Jones, Honey West, Kentucky Jones, Mr. Novak, Kung Fu, Star Trek, among others. These shows earned enough money that I could pay for a little house in the valley. It's been paid for now for 20 years, and I find I can save money on Social Security. I have been fortunate in being frugal. I have not invested my money in fly-by-night operations. I tend to pay everything with cash rather than with checks. I am iconoclastic to the sense that I don't believe anything I hear. When I look at television these days, it seems to me that not only the stories, I mean not only the commercials, but everything about them, the news and the entertainment, are all in some way fraudulent, empty, and have at their base a lie. Which makes me conclude that the American public has become accepting of the fact that everybody that you do business with lies. So that when all of their money goes south because of some Ponzi scheme they've invested in, there's no reason for them to be surprised that the people that they're dealing with the bright suits on and the clean offices, are cheats and crooks without moral fiber and without any sense of shame. See, I don't know what it is about me, but I would be humiliated if anybody thought anything I said was a lie concocted to improve my status in the situation. I would be humiliated by that. To me, lying, cheating, stealing, breaking your word, failures in loyalty or in self-presentation of self, you present yourself as a good fellow, but when someone comes to you asking that you be a good fellow, you say, no, I'm of another group. I don't believe in your philosophy. All because everything you say and you do is putting up a front, a facade, that is supposed to be you, but isn't really you. The you that lets its hair down and sometimes yells at its friends. No, that's the more real you. And to be able to find a way to express that has been my goal. To try to let everyone know that I'm not part of the club. Whatever presumptions you have about me, abandon them now. I may not be prepared to accept the terms of our friendship as you propose them. I put this in very euphemistic terms, but it keeps me outside. I've always been outside. I understand what it is to be outside on every level. What I believe is not what the body politic believes. Almost every one of my deepest held concepts in my world are heretical to the vast population out there. I am a fan of Jesus Christ, but I think Christians really give him a bad name. I think Christians are creepy. And that sort of makes me weird to think, oh, I'm confessing, I'm a Christian. Well, yes, I am. Okay, now that as an introduction is who I am, or who I believe myself to be. I may prove to be wrong. I'll say, gentlemen, I was wrong. I won't protest when it turns out to be different than I think it is. But what I think it is grander than all of the dreams of heaven. I think we have all thought or dreamed about what heaven might be, to get rid of all the grubby necessities of this world and to translate to some world where, and then there is our dream. Narcissistic perhaps, megalomaniac perhaps, but there it is, our heaven. And Why do we believe that? Because the heaven will turn out to be grander than anything you ever thought about. It will so transpose your reality in the ways that consuming marijuana transforms your reality. Some really good pot can put you into a state of mind in which you hardly recognize your former self. There is the word transcend. There's the word transcendent. Transcendent. What is it to be transcendent? To step over some barrier that separates the world you know from the world that is. What blindness makes you perceive everything around you as you see it? What group metaphysic, hypnosis, do we have going for us that allows us to envision cities that go straight up? Why is that inspiring to us to think of a tower? But it is, and we got to come to terms with that. We got to find out why. Yes, exactly. We've got to find out why, so that we can gain some measure of control over what we do. Because we stand at a threshold. Emile Zola recognized it at the end of the 19th century. When he looked around and he said, we're in an immensely fertile world. We can produce or manufacture anything we desire. We just need to turn our most fertile minds on it, and any problem we have can be solved because we are living in a magical universe that wants us to succeed. Now, how to make an ordinary person trapped in a mesh of responsibilities and debts to turn his eye toward the idea that, hey, this is just a dream you're caught up in. It's a collective dream, we're all supporting it, but if we changed our minds and started to turn this back into the Garden of Eden, it would be quick work. Because that's all it is what we desire, what we want, what we fear. What we feared the most came upon us. That's this economy thing. We've been through this before, the Great Depression. I'm a child of it. I was born in 1929, the very year the stock market crashed. And everybody became different than they were before. And it was use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. It was an economy of want. It was a situation in which you did not realize you were poor because everybody in the grubby city was poor. They were all living threadbare lives, all because of economics, which what the hell has that really got to do with anything? But somehow it does, and it stops our fecundity, what Emile Zola called it, our ability to bring forth new things. Now we're facing that same situation again today. We've got every bit of everything we need to do it with. We've got the will to try to do it. Do we have the wisdom to figure out how to do it? But the truth is that the 21st century lies ahead of us. It is going to be an age, unlike any other age, of old truths dying and new truths being born on every level, to the point where we, in a very short order, will all live the life of gods and end up conquering the bloody universe. I haven't any doubt of it. I see it in everything that develops in every way and every day. I will only be sorry not to be here to see it all come to pass as I watch the new toys that you see in stores for the use of the new iPhone, of which there are 5 billion of them out there in the universe, and some guy in Egypt became one of the richest men in the world by manufacturing telephones for Indonesia or Arabia or Egypt. But anyway, he sold, I think, 300 million or 3 billion or some large number of cell phones. They're out there, they all tune in on the internet. The internet has become very cozy because so far it doesn't cost anything unless you want to order something, and therefore is a great source of information and allows us all to communicate with each other. Now, what will we do with that and all of the new toys that go with it? How will we learn from this new capability we have to communicate with each other and to form small nests, if you will, of belief about this or that? Ultimately, they'll have a larger impact on the world. But that all lies ahead of us. It's going to take time to get there. But I see it right now.
Excellent. That's a good intro.
You might mention in the introduction that George is producing an episode, a version of Kick the Can.
Now you're doing a new version.
Which was an episode on the Twilight Zone.
Right, one of the few that I remember wholeheartedly.
I'm doing it without any sets or props. I'm doing it just with lights and with cameras in a big black space. And it's going to be thoroughly engaging because it deals with the strategies we use to try to avoid the idea of death.
But really, you're 6 years old right now, kicking a can around the yard, right?
Yeah, really. I'm a child with great potential. I'm an unused resource. I'm ready to start to go producing an endless amount of, not endless, but a large amount of content for this new media, the internet. I have access to the brightest people around. If they weren't really good citizens, they'd be dangerous hackers. And with all of this access to people, places, and things, stories, and I mean the stories of Richard Matheson or Charles Beaumont or Rod Serling or Ray Bradbury, they all know me. They'd be happy to sell me their material for my television wannabe, or I call it television, but it's really cell phone. Shows designed for the cell phone. So I'm involved in that too. You know, really daring to accept your oddness is half of the game. Not to worry about, well, I'm not like them, or they. You know, forget that. Walk proud. They look at you like the mares look at the stallion on the hill. The way he tosses his mane, looks around, he doesn't give a damn for them. They come to him. He didn't go to them. That attitude, that really will serve you well in your private life. Because it has me. I'm to the point of I'm willing to be a little rude in order to let people know that don't understand me too quickly. I'm doing my best to communicate who I am. But this is still all subterfuge as to who I really am. There are times when I'm really a social creature. There are times when I'm very critical and I want to be alone.
I've actually thought about that. It's like some people's ideas, they need to be shaken up, and it's almost like surgery. It's like, what can you give people to take the pain of the disruption of ideas? When you come in with some ideas or thoughts or questions to try to disrupt their world just so they could accept some sort of like truth in order to find it. And the whole process of like trying to awaken a mind is almost like surgery. It can be painful and some people may not like it, so you have to provide some sort of like verbal anesthetic.
It's also got to be delicate.
Right.
You got to reach in and touch that spot and not wake up all their other alarm systems.
Right.
I try to be intellectual. I try to put a veneer of academia. Not much. Too much, and it becomes bland. But the ability to choose some of these longer words, fit them into the mosaic, and to come off as a guy who wears glasses, you know, a modern man, creatures using all of the greatest and newest advances. So I lie in a way. My public image is that I'm an intellectual. My private image is that I'm a hooligan, really, that I'm willing to throw something through that window, if it'll make the point.
Throw a brick at the glass house?
Yeah, and or insult the president and his wife or something. But at a certain point, I'm not going to put up with their crap. And knowing myself well enough to choose, I trust myself a lot. I don't have a lot of inhibition. I have a lot because I'm naturally self-conscious and I want everybody to think the best of me. So I walk on eggshells to be polite and nice. But that's all peripheral to what I'm thinking or what I believe.
Isn't that the human condition?
I guess it really is. I guess I'm just a walking example of the human condition. But they don't talk about it, and so they're hardly aware that that's the world they're living in. But I blather about everything. My button says, let me do the talking. I really believe that.
Okay. Walking conversation machine. You wear all these buttons so people could just kind of like press it for different conversations to get.
What's that? Oh, let me give you a lecture.
Hey, what does this button do?
My first book, in the acknowledgments, it says here, George Clayton Johnson, for your input and teaching how to observe.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Right here.
That's great. You know what I think? That little book that I'm talking to you about could be a sales tool for this book.
Well, you know what I'm thinking is I can't wait for you to read that one, and then I'm going to have to get you a copy of this other one.
I will, Mr. Urban, that there's something we'll end up doing together about this mushroom thing. Because I think Jack is right, that all of these early guys, aware that the mushroom was their power, tried to conceal this, even while putting it in their artwork. And in order to talk to each other, they had to invent a code. And Jack Herer believes he's cracked that code, and that they're really talking to each other about their enthusiasm for this new fact that the mushroom was sacred. And why? I don't know. It's a spore, after all, so it could have drifted between the planets. Could come from another world. I wouldn't make a guess that it did. That we stopped being aborigines when this stuff started to appear in a world where food supplies were at a minimum and where they would try anything to see if it was edible.
And you know, there's actually two different speculative theories of evolution that are based on exactly that. One of them by Terence McKenna and another one by Peter Webster.
I'd give them credit too, in my book. I'd say, as McKenna has remarked, this and this and this and this, and etc. So it is both scholarly, parenthetically, but it's also, you fools, what you believed was all false. It has finally been revealed. This happened, this happened, this happened. Here are books to support this idea. Other writers have noticed this. Other students, what is a good word there?
Scholars.
Other scholars have noticed this.
Would you classify yourself as a scholar? An intellectual?
I think of myself as a science fiction fan. On my gravestone, what does it say? It says, science fiction fan. Since that, I've changed it because I got an award at the San Diego Comic-Con. The award is called the Friend of Fandom Award.
The Friend of?
Friend of Fandom.
Okay.
Now, I'm a friend of fandom because I recognize it as the only leaderless society that I know of. Where there's nobody in charge. Where there's nobody can throw you out. Where there's no central committee or group of people for the last word on it. It's got so many heads, it's like Hydra. Every city has its own producer of the convention. And they may do several of them, and then they're replaced by some other. And while they're in charge at that convention, we are not worthy. We are not worthy. But the minute this convention is over, they become part of the rank and file again, and we can take and beat them up if we want to. And they know that. So we're all very civilized. We operate basically by Robert's Rules of Order. Everything is done by committee decision, including such rules as every fourth year, the World Science Fiction Convention has to take place in another country. And then people bid on that, and then we decide this year it'll be Berlin, and the next year it'll be Tokyo. And but it goes on bureaucratically, administratively. Records are kept because almost all fans are historians and collectors and bibliophiles and the like. Anyway, I like these clever people that want to be filmmakers and writers and actors and directors and producers and publicists and makeup people and disco costume designers and dancers and singers. All those people, I really feel an identification with them. And they're at their most concentrated at places like the San Diego Comic-Con. I'm a guest at something called the Emerald City Comic-Con in Seattle in March. But I like to think of myself as, definitely, that's the role I'm playing. A friend of fandom. The idea of a leaderless society is very efficient and is very good at allocating authority to minor people for given periods of time in order to further the grand plan. It has to do with the love of fantastic literature, comics, art. The Comic-Con started with because of comic strips, not because of comic books. People like Milton Caniff and Hal Foster, who did Prince Valiant, Vern Hogarth, who did Tarzan. These were literally guys who drew these damn strips. And the stories they told were just astonishing. Just astonishing stories. And I fell in love with them as a child. Including the books of Oz. So the concept of the Emerald City as being the home place of this convention is very appealing. I've always wanted to go to the Emerald City. 50 years. Many of the things that I'm the most famous for these days, like The Twilight Zone or Ocean's 11, they took place when I was 28, 29, 30 years old. I was at the peak of my health. My marriage was going well. I was earning enough to pay the bills and had the freedom to go to conventions, and I went to about 6 of them a year. And in the course of it, I got to meet many world-class artists, lecturers, talkers, actors, etc. I've met Barbara Streisand. I've met Walter Matthau. I know these people. They know me. How did I get to here? By choosing as my major recreation science fiction conventions. I went to my very first one in 1958 at the Alexandria Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. It was billed as Southgate in 58 because a fan named Rick Sneary had started to suggest the idea of a world convention in Los Angeles in his home city of Southgate. But Southgate could not handle the traffic that came as a result of this, so it all took place at this Alexandria, where I met Ray Bradbury and Paul Anderson. Many, many really, really names. Clifford Simic, who wrote a great novel called City. And there I am getting my photograph taken with this guy. Paul Anderson, very famous writer whose son-in-law Greg Bear is now told by Ray Bradbury to be the new big coming thing. Who's going to be the big writer of this coming future? it's going to be Greg Bear. A lot of people thought Clive Barker. No, it's going to be Greg. Why? Because Ray said so, and Ray's smart about these things. And we're all a family, and we all know each other. And this stuff travels through our grapevine. Right now, I'm involved as part of the Sheldorf fan club. And what we're trying to do is to organize a Sheldorf tribute that will have a banquet in San Diego at the El Cortez Hotel, and we'll be encouraging the city to name a street after Sheldorf, Sheldorf Way, some new suburb, you know. We've got a lot of plans like that. There are half a dozen of us charter founding fathers of the San Diego Comic-Con who look back at the early years of it and are now trying to sort of recreate that spirit in honoring a tribute to the man who produced the first 10 of the damn things and got together all these world-class artists like Jack Kirby, the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, and a lot of other comic books. And so I'm part of that. And I'm a part of this, and I'm a part of that, and I'm a part of that. And it's the will of the wisp, and wherever my enthusiasms take me, and only doing what I want to do, not what others really want me to do. Fortunately, mostly they want me to do what I want to do. Like in your case, for me to sit here at this table, eating and shooting my mouth off. But I love that. I do have real ambitions about the internet. I believe it really is a miracle. Alvin Toffler, in his book Future Shock, he said, we've gotten to a state in our society where there are just too many decisions, important decisions, have to be made. And they have to be made based on information. Because if they go wrong, one day you'll go to the supermarket and there won't be any toilet paper because somebody forgot to order the logs. Something fell apart. We got to be very careful about that, he said. Because how can we make decisions? We've got ways to do it with legislatures, with congresses, with committees, with boards of directors, with czars, individuals placed in charge of this or that. And those people have to know what they're doing, or something important starts to come apart. But how can we do that? Because of the rising numbers and the rising complexity, we won't be able to do it until we find a way to rise to a new level of relatedness. We have to find a new way to fit ourselves together. And just about the time he said this, along came this idea of connecting a lot of typewriters together and calling it a network. And it allowed us to rise to a new level of relatedness, so that now many of our decisions are very much better than they might have been. And that being the case, the quality of our lives should go up. Products should be better. Things should be safer, stronger, longer lasting, less expensive. And in time, they probably will. But I really do believe in the future. I see it shining there. I guess science fiction has helped me prepare me for it, to make me think in new ways. One of my principal heroes is Horry Ackerman. Do you know who he is?
No.
Ackerman started many, many years ago collecting stuff. And the stuff he collected was remarkable. The armature for King Kong in the movie. The robot that was in Metropolis. The seven faces of Dr. Lau. One thing after another, until finally he had a real museum of unique science fiction stuff. And eventually it grew into something called the Acker Mansion. A vast library of stills, photos, one-sheets, books, apparatus, devices that all represented some aspect of science fiction, including one locked glass case that contained hundreds of different versions or editions of the book Dracula by Bram Stoker. And every time I would go into the Acker Museum, I'd be astonished that one man with fairly ordinary resources had managed to get hold of so many world-class treasures that I was not surprised when Berlin offered him $1 million for a selection of stuff from the Acker Mansion to put on display in their science fiction biblioteca or whatever in Germany. And he took the $1 million, let them take what they wanted, then went out to his garage and began to pull that stuff out of storage and put it all back again. His Acker Museum, Acker Mansion, was the envy of anyone who has ever collected anything. And he himself was the center of a group of social people that met periodically for dinners, banquets, addresses, commemorations, tributes, and parties at various places, of which I went to dozens of them, to see the way that this man, Forrest J. Ackerman, managed to somehow remain the king of the fans, even though it was a leaderless society and had no leaders. But a proclamation by Corey, who was publisher-editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland and had a column in there, and a lot of dorky sci-fi fans who were really into monsters as his handmaidens. Anyway, I've always been a strong supporter of this guy. I think he is God-given. Someone had to fill that ecological niche. And it was this guy named Forrest J., no dot, never put a dot after his middle initial. Forrest J., no dot, Ackerman. He became a good friend of mine, as did many of his friends and disciples, including Ray Bradbury. The foremost guys on dinosaurs, William Stout and Donald Clute. They're very, very dear fans of Forrest. See them at all his parties. And one might wonder, as an audience, well, what's so special about all this? I don't know, but it's transcendental. It's more than special. Late in later years, people will look back and say, what was the accelerator under everything that kept the 20th century bubble, 21st century bubbling like it is doing? And the answer is science fiction fandom. It's all those wannabe people who see the media as their way of escaping the world. They'll become publishers or editors or writers or actors or stuntmen or makeup people or costume designers or cinematographers or technicians or editors, or and that's what they all want to be. They're all wannabe filmmakers. They're all in love with the best extravagances of the film world, and I am one of them. I hang out with them, understand them, encourage them, and that's what I find in fandom, is a large, large number, large proportion of them are of that breed, and they are the smartest ones. I'm working with a guy right now that if he had it in his nature, he could be hacking into the Pentagon or wherever they think they got their secrets, because he's that clever on the World Wide Web. And how did I just happen to run across this guy? It's happening to me more and more. How did I just happen to run across the guy who's the guy on mushrooms now that Jack isn't functioning? It's you. How is this? Well, through this and that and this and that. Well, what drew us together? Why did you care whether I lived or vice versa? Well, because of this and that and this and that. Fortuitous as hell. But almost in my sense of thinking, predestined. At a certain early age, the gods said, yeah, let's provide the framework so that ultimately they'll end up with some mutual plan.
Well, you know, you were my big inspiration in my early 20s to become a writer in the first place.
Was that?
Yeah. Because I spent so much time with you and Jack that I decided then that I wanted to write.
I remember once being congratulated by a girl. Her name was Shirley Jonas, and she was a beatnik living in Laurel Canyon, and we used to all party together. But I took a story for her to read called Thorndike that I had talked to her about, and she came back to me with a compliment that really made me thrill. But she was saying, congratulations, of all this group of writers, you're the first person I know who's written anything. Fell down. Wasn't even as great writing, it's just you did it. You typed it out and gave it to me. Nobody else does that. We all talk big, but their novel's a big secret. And probably an illusion.
This guy should be a writer too. In fact, he started out that way.
Yeah, I was a journalism major.
Well, I was talking to Ray before, while you went away, about the benefits to be gained from just learning how to put words on paper. Just the sheer experience of writing dumb sentences that may not be great, but they're forcing you to do a self-evaluation. You're digging into your literary knowledge and your history, your dramatic sense of drama, your idea about the value of the meanings of words, and you're making delicate choices because you know that hopefully at some future time intelligent eyes are going to be looking at this and they're going to say, oh, how dumb, or they're going to say, oh, how clever, how bright, how insightful, how direct. And so you should learn to write only because it's one of the tools of the gentleman. If, like right now, I take myself very seriously. I would not be intimidated to talk to the head of the studio or the head of the network or the president of the United States. I would not diminish myself just because he's the president. I gotta watch myself. No, in fact, I've become braver. I'm talking to the fucking president of the United States. I want him to know who I am. I'm going to get up there in his face. You know, I'm going to lead the conversation. I'm going to want to abandon protocol. Why? Because if I fall into line, then I'm easily manipulated. But if I don't, if I'm brave enough to remain contrary and walk on water. But how to walk on water? Learn yourself through the practice of writing, trying to make a statement, to make a point. Take some idea you have, write it down in 3 pages to persuade me that you're right about it. And that would be train you so much, just doing that one little act, that if you did that frequently, choose some point of view you have and try to justify it. Like, I think I could make a touching and emotional plea for almost anything that you hate. You hate child molesters?
Sure.
I could write an essay about why you should become a child molester. Why child molesting is good, not only for you, but for the child. If you have any instinct for the preservation of the race, my God, you should not withhold information from that child of any kind. No, let him get it with the bark off. Man, oh man, I could make an argument that people would look at that and say, people I knew thought of that and make them reflect a bit on what our prejudicial beliefs, and to learn what your prejudicial beliefs are by setting yourself the challenge of trying to write something down to prove a point that everybody knows you're wrong about, but trying to make a coherent, legitimate, emotional, because if it can become emotional, it doesn't have to even be factual. It just touches upon their racial, ancient beliefs that come from, you know, historical reality. Like you were talking about Mithra. Mithra is the Christ legend all over again. Mithra of the broad pastures, whose mother was Uhura. These characters, well, there she is, Mary, Mother of God. There she is, Jesus Christ. There he is, the bulrushes. There he is, being put adrift in a basket. There he is, this and that, related to the sun, idealized this way and that way and this way. All because of the propensity of the human mind toward this messianic attitude, trying to find absolutes in a world that's too complicated for that. Obey no necessities. No necessities. There's words that goes before that, I can't think of it at the moment. But there's so many things where you have to do this or that. No, you don't have to do either this or that. No, those alternatives do not exhaust reality. Beans and corn make a complete protein. I think beans have 7 of the amino acids and the corn has the other 2.
That's right, you're vegetarian. You know how to form complete proteins.
Yeah, I know how to eat. So that I might find myself reflecting on what is this? Ah, I see why.
Talk about Logan's Run. It seems like the ultimate totalitarian society.
Yeah, it's really big news. Think what the government, whatever we call that, requires. They can seize your home. They can draft you and place you in dire jeopardy of your life. They can take your money. They can take your land. What else might they want to do? What is the desire of government? Where would it like to go? You'd like to be able to decide how long you live. Stamp, you're going to live to be 60 because you took this test at 18. But if you failed this test, then you'd have been executed at 50. They'll do that. They'll begin to decide what lives are desirable, what ones are not, what ones are drags on the society.
Do you think we're already in that stage with this whole eugenics crap going on? Or continuation of World War II that's happening right now?
I think we're developing it in so many ways. Just the idea of criterion. It represents a good citizen. A conforming unit of a broader group. And what is the nature of the group? Is it a totalitarian thing? Is it a collective? That's the odds are very great that it'll be a collective of some kind. So that in the process, the individual becomes meaningless. That your name, your identity, your accomplishments, your wit, your beauty, none of these things matter anymore because you're a number. I'm writing the lyric for a song that starts out, "You've taken away my Christian name and given me a number. It all happened while I slept, while I was deep in slumber." It's beginning a story about that. Because I've been reading some books that equate the word freedom with property rights. Your life is your property. The product of your hand is your property. If you relinquish it by selling your hours of existence for wages from some company, that's your fault. But you own it. It is your property. Now, if you start thinking of property rights instead of this abstract word freedom, you can get a much clearer idea of what's worth protecting. What really a value is so intrinsic that you cannot sell it. Like your life itself. Can you sell your life? Apparently these mad bombers are being talked into it. We'll give your family $20,000 if you'll blow yourself up in the skies. That way you can provide for your children. Okay, I'll do it. Life is hopeless otherwise. There's no other answer. So desperately they do it. But I do believe that the danger is the collective. And as an antidote to that, I would read a book called Anthem by Ayn Rand. She talks about we. We do this, we do that. These are our orders. These are what we do. And it's only on the very last page of the book that we see the word I. Because, no, we is not the answer. We didn't do anything. I did this and you did that. It collectively it amounted to something, but it wasn't a we. I wrote the script, you directed the movie, we didn't make the film. You know, although that's the way they would present it. But what is the meaning of meaning? No, two positives make a negative. Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. That's a negative, because I don't believe you. Yeah, sure. You're telling me a lie. Yeah, sure. Two positives making a negative. The language is so flexible. They call it a roach clip because pot holder was taken. That's the way the world works. That we modify our thoughts to meet the circumstance. And we use language as a tool. We call him a suspect. If we don't call him a suspect and merely call him a person of interest, we can intrude into his affairs at will. If we call him a suspect, he's entitled to certain rights. What shall we call him? Well, let's call him a person of interest. Of course. And so everybody is a person of interest, not a suspect, and therefore not subject to having their rights defended.
And therefore their guard is down.
And therefore they're helpless in the face of whatever force is arrayed against them. Well, so much for these nihilistic thoughts. I basically am a very positive person. I think everything's going to work out all right.
It's good to have a few optimists out there. I think I've fallen into the pessimist category in the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, I really do believe that we'll get the handle on it. We're pretty clever.
I have a one-liner. I tried to join an optimist club, but I don't think I'm going to make it.
That's so bloody true. Isn't language miraculous what it can do? The trouble is, people are too critical. That's the answer to this thing. The trouble is, people are too critical.
Yeah, that's why it's good to hang around with you for a little bit again for the first time.
Well,
in one,
I thank you
years.
Very much for astrotheology, which I will treasure because I believe sincerely that you are very much right. And they're finding a way to take it out of academia, which is where we all work, because that lends it legitimacy. Let's take it into the ballyhoo. Well, everything you write is potentially rich for a story. The whole idea of the ventricles of the brain, there's a real story in that. Some man with a theory. It's the butterflies. Kundalini. I got a character in a story named Kundalini. Wouldn't it be really, really great to be able to focus your energies, whatever they may be, in such a way as to, in quotes, gain control of this organ? Because is it a means of extrasensory communication? Is it a way of uniting ourselves with the mother of the gods? Oh, who knows what? I mean, I try to be speculative, only to be ridiculous, but I do think that, for example, I believe we're all telepathic. I think before the age of electronic media and radio waves, all of that stuff, that people were very much more in tune with what the other persons were thinking. They were listening to the thoughts in the other person's head much clearer than they are now because of the buzz of energies. It keeps me from being aware of your reflective state or his newly energized state or whatever. I'm not aware of that. And so we just continue talking. But what if we all became progressively aware of the rapport that we have created between ourselves through our relatedness?
That's what we call getting on the same page.
Yeah, getting on the same page. But what does that mean in terms of extrasensory da-da-da-da. Vibes, vibes. See, I believe that the human hair is the really the organ of vibes. I think that's why women have always been more intuitional than men, because men have almost always forced each other to divest themselves of hair toward the image of a warrior. And that was their responsibility, was defending and fighting and all of that. But they kept their women barefoot, they kept their women with long hair. And therefore the women developed into a breed of cat that I find unbelievable. For example, as far as I can tell, they have no organization. They have no Congress, no Senate, no judicial branch, no organ or society or group dedicated to fostering feminine ideals or virtues or what have you. That I find, must be a lot of women have noticed that the men have got all these goddamn societies. They exchange information with each other. They organize each other in hierarchies of power. They set forward objectives and they run the show. And of course these organizations have something to do with it. And why don't we quietly organize ourselves so that we know who's the head witch in our neighborhood and where to go to get this or to get that? Well, we must not let the men know. Of course not. That would be a total disaster. They got all their groups, but we've got the coven, or whatever they call it, and they get themselves together. Now, historically, there have been times when we believed that was so, that the women were in on it, whatever it was. And how did they pass this along? So that their daughters knew it too, because they never spoke and they didn't have meeting, and they very rarely even met each other. And how was that done? Or was it done? Is it really true that they have no organization? And how mad they are, how crazy they are, to not be able to protect themselves with an organization, no structure of some kind, so as to be able to unite in the face of danger or whatever the hell. Just makes no sense that they don't. So I keep wondering, what is the secret society? Was it Wicca? No, that's witch stuff. It's trite. It's so common that everyone knows about it and thinks about it. Now, it's something much more subtle than this motherhood that runs through all of these mothers, where they look at each other and they recognize each other. And do they have secret hand signals or ways that they press the flesh and lets each of them know that you're a sister, a ya-ya sisterhood? Every time I hear something like that, I think it's probably some writer stumbled upon something truly important about the females that we males do not know. But every one of them knows. But they would die before they told it. See, that's fantasy, but that's my game. Is to think outside the box, to think the unthinkable, to wonder what would be like if. Like this whole idea of eating flesh, eating animals, it's got so many brutal aspects. You watch them destroy the cows, cut them up, hack them into pieces. You watch the way they treat the chicken just to get the eggs. You watch the way they treat the cows just to get the milk. And all of this is predatory. And is it right? Because the lion is a predator on the gazelle, and he eats the meat. And so can't we be a predator on the lion and eat the meat? And why? Because it contains high levels of energy, and you can translate it right directly into your body just by merely consuming it. And so let's do that. And along the way, I'm sure a bunch of people thought about that and said, something wrong there. Let's rethink this thing with animals. Why should they flee from us when they see us coming? Because we'll throw rocks at them, that's why. Because we'll yell at them and shake a stick at them and run from them. No. But somewhere out there, there's a real neat answer. And I would love to be the first one to come across the answer, even if I never saw the reason for it. But there's so many just inexplicable things that I just
cannot understand. I just don't understand. This whole economic system is part of the culprit. The idea of, well, for example, take our teachers. They're no longer teachers. They're job holders.
Well, not only that, but they're just teaching kids a bunch of crap to be good little followers and soldiers and employees.
Yeah, that's because they're holding down these jobs that require them to teach the kids to be little robots and future soldiers and great consumers. But the teachers know this. The teachers see the new pincers they're putting around every school to keep the predators out, but it also keeps the parents out so that it gives them even more mind control over the kids, so that by the time they're 7, they know not to run with scissors, to hold up their hand if they want to be recognized, that if they go to the bathroom, that they stay on the right path, that anyone who's an adult can tell them what to do, and it's law. And they inculcate so many ideas that by the time they're 7 or 8 or 9, they've completely lost any sense of themselves as a self, as an entity, and they become a cog, they become a pupil. What an ugly word, a pupil.
What's interesting is the just complete revival recently of home education and teaching kids the 7 liberal arts and critical thinking and all the things that school has removed. And It's quite interesting to see this revolution. There's a whole movement to take down the public school systems right now.
I'm not the only one that's noticed it, apparently. But my first move, if I ran the country, I would close all of the classrooms. I would let teachers rent the classrooms for exhibitions or displays or talks or lectures. And they could rent the classrooms and get the students in there. But not by any compulsion. I'd give the student back all of his time. I'd make his parents responsible for him learning how to read and write and do arithmetic and all the commonly needed social skills.
That's what's happening right now.
And if they don't do it or don't want to do it, I would make teachers into freelancers so they could become tutors and take over that job for the parents on the level of hand-to-hand, journeyman to apprentice, not teacher to pupil. I would remind everybody that the word education comes from the word educe, and the word educe merely means to explain. So those teachers, educators, are merely explainers. Please, teacher, explain to me, what is this business with numbers? Oh, let me tell you about numbers. It's a one-on-one thing. They've been doing it wrong, and they know it. The penal system's a terrible loss on every level, but they keep doing it. They're afraid of the prisoners. They've created such a ruthless breed of people in there, they don't know what to do with them. Even in restricted situations like Cuba. What do we do with our prisoners?
Send them to the U.S. in Castro's.
We've made them hate us. We dare not put them on the street because they'll blow us up. They know that. Can't they do something about it? TB or not TB, that is congestion. Consumption, be done about it. No. Consumption cannot be done about it. For some reason, we're on a dead course for the edge of the world, for oblivion. The skies are falling in. We dare not admit it.
So you're not quite the optimist.
Well,
you're a realist, too.
I have optimism that
you're
I will...
You're a sore optimist.
I will float like a petal on the turgid waves. I know that my life is... God likes me. And so that whatever happens, I'll be in an advantageous position to observe it and report on it. Because I'm very dedicated to doing that, to pointing out things that people don't see.
Do you have any children?
2. A boy, 56, and a girl, 50. Girl has 2 children. One is 22, one is 18. one is going for a master's degree at a university. The other one is just entering college. My son has no children. He's a musician. He helped me make a number of albums. He made money off of his music. But he's also discouraged. He's, you know, when he was 25, he wanted to be a rock star. But at 50, he doesn't want to be a rock star anymore. So now what's worth to be? What do you want to be? Well, when anything is possible, nothing is interesting. So I look at the poor devil, and the only thing I can tell him is, spend your time doing something you love doing. Don't let anybody tell you that you need a job. You'll survive. Maybe from time to time, a pretty grubby existence, but they can't kill you. Doesn't take that much food. You can sleep in a corner as long as you can protect yourself while you're asleep. I just read a story by my friend William F. Nolan, who, like myself, has had 50 years of writing. And I just appeared in this new book of short stories, and I saw that he had a story in there too. So I read his story. The story's about a guy who's living in Bend, Oregon. He's in Bend, Oregon. Dismayed by all the snow and the sleet. Tired of it. Feeling lost. And the more he thinks, the more lost he gets. He starts to realize that all of his younger friends that he started out with are all dead. That many other friends are dead. That this one died. This one had this happen to him. That one had that happen to him. This one a stroke. That one a heart attack. This one alcoholism. This one whatever. And the more he talks, and it's really truthful stuff, because I see the names of people I know in there. And I know this guy's talking about himself. And he's doing a good job of showing how much of a disaster it can be to be able to have a long, long life to where finally all of the people that you knew are gone. Even the younger ones that, for one reason or another, many of them are no longer around. You're all alone. And then you begin thinking, what was it that caused this? Part of it is discipline, a regimen of food and drink that makes sense. Part of it is genetics. Mother lived to be 85. Father to 87. He has plenty of reason to believe that he could live a long life. He's been very healthy. And the more he thinks like this, the more he realizes that basically he's as strong as a horse, and that, so it's sleeting outside, big goddamn deal. The sun's going to come out. And the more he thinks like that, the more he realizes how damn lucky he is and how much he's looking forward to living. And it starts out all the reasons why he's got no reason to live anymore. And it's just a beautiful piece of work. I want to call him up and tell him that I think so. Because it's so autobiographical, so true, so self-revealing about his own history and state of mind. It's utterly true. As you read it, you know. It's an absolutely true thing that happened to him. He just suddenly realized, my God, I'm lucky that I did outlive all those other people. And that there are other people out there to meet and to get to know.
I've got an aunt that's 103. She's starting to outlive her children.
Oh boy, that's no fun. I wouldn't like to do that.
And this is the interesting part, is her sister is 104 and her brother is 100. But they're outliving their own children.
I have such admiration for them. I recently went to the funeral of a lady who was 100 years old. Very famous lady in the movie business. She was in the first Dracula film. She's the daughter of Carl Lindley, who started Lindley Theaters and all of that stuff. So I was one of the celebrities there, honoring her. And I said to her from the stage, I said, Carla, everyone in this theater admires you. For myself, the most precious thing I own in my life, the most precious thing in my life is my life. And I really admire the way, the tenacious way that you have clung to yours. And the theater just fucking broke up. They said, that's exactly what we feel. It was a really a wonderful moment. But I find myself in awe when I'm around somebody who's made it to 100, because I'd love to be able to do that. And I hope to be able to.